I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Roy. By the grace of a power greater than myself, I haven't found it necessary to drink today. And I haven't found it necessary to drink since the 22nd of April, 1990. And for that, I'm grateful. And a lot of people whom you don't know are grateful too that I'm not drinking anymore. I really have to begin tonight by making an amends to this group. Enough people already called me on it, so. A few years ago, I was invited to speak here and to do the beginner series, and I did the first 3 weeks, and then God in his wisdom decided to strike me down sick. See how I bring God into it and spread the blame? But anyway, I was sick, and I never came back for the 4th week to finish the cycle. So I apologize, and they gave me another chance, so this time, hopefully, we'll make it. So like I said, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Roy, and I haven't drunk for, you know, almost 22 years. And if you haven't met me before, the accent is from India. It's not from that other country. And I did most of my drinking in India and Europe and those kind of places. And I got sober in India. And 1, 2, and 3. When I finally got sober, my sponsor said to me, suit up and show up. So, here I am. Got dressed, came in. But I wasn't dressed like this the day I got sober. The day I got sober, I was in a pair of shorts. My back was in a brace. My neck was in a collar. And I had about 36 stitches in my head. I'd come out of a coma from a bike accident. So let me backtrace to let you know exactly how unmanageable my life was and how powerless I was, not only over alcohol, but over alcoholism. And I was a product of a mixed marriage. My father's side of the family is Catholic. My mother's side of the family is Hindu. And depending which grandmother I spent the weekend with, I was repeatedly informed that the other half were the wrong kind and going to a wrong place. So, you know, it's very confusing. It's very confusing when you're 6 years old and, but if they're my first cousins, how come they're going to hell? And if those are my first cousins, how come they're going to hell? So I had plenty of spiritual identity confusion. I guess that's, I love that. I just heard of that. And so it was extremely easy for me at age 16 when my father died to say to my mom and anybody else who had forced me to go to places of worship before that, say, I'm not coming back. Everyone's burning up anyway. So that's really how I grew up. My parents were both dental surgeons. They entertained a lot. And every Saturday night, there'd be parties at home. So I wasn't a stranger to alcohol growing up. You know, every Saturday night, I'd see all these adults that be, I'd see them drinking, obviously, but there'd be laughter, there'd be dancing, there'd be singing around the piano, and then they'd eat dessert and go home. So different from my story later on. But, so I grew up around that. My grandmother would make a bottle of children's wine, and we'd be given a glass of wine, you know, Christmas, Easter, New Year, days and occasions of national importance. And when you have Christianity, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Hinduism, Islam, and God knows how many other religions in India, you have plenty and days and occasions of national importance. So, and then by the time we got to age 10, we got graduated from my granny's children's wine to this vile concoction the British left behind called Shandy. So if you took about an inch and a half of beer and topped up the glass with lemonade, it was okay to give it to kids. And so we got graduated to that. And again, Christmas, meals, we'd have that, no big deal. The only alcoholism I really saw in this stretch was my grandmother's brother. This guy was really cool. Whenever we had parties, he'd come early. He'd come to the back room where we kids were hanging around. He always had this little gray bag over his arm and we'd be dipping in there. And he told us these amazing stories of how he almost died and how he almost killed somebody and how he lost something and how he was so broke, and he told these outlandish stories. And oh wow, this is great. I had no idea he was telling my story, but you know. But he was a really cool uncle, because he'd give us money and send us to the store to get cigarettes and peanuts. And he was one of those keep the change kind of fellows, you know, what we get like after three drinks. And he couldn't remember if he gave us $5 or $50. Hence, he was the favorite uncle. But the highlight was really that he would be counted on to do something spectacular. He'd take a header into the cake. He'd break a bottle of my dad's best scotch, you know, or something outlandish. And then we wouldn't see him again for 2 or 3 months. But he was kind, and he was funny, and he was patient, and he was generous, and he had time for us kids. And I wanted to be like him when I grew up. I got my wish. The only difference between his story and mine is that he died and I didn't. So in 1982, we had a lot in common. We both worked in the airlines, we both rode motorcycles. Yes, I know I don't look like a biker anymore. My wife only allows me to have one which doesn't have an engine now. So, but my uncle was coming home from the airport one morning, and three sheets to the wind, lost control, hit his head on the curb, went into a coma, died. That was 1982 or thereabouts. And I still vividly remember my cousin Neil and I. You know, we had made this uncle a promise that when he died, we'd empty a bottle of booze over his grave. And after the funeral, we snuck back to do that. And even while we were doing that, I was thinking, what a waste of good booze, you know. That was his story. For me, it was a little different. I finished school, and I did the things that kids my age in India do. You're kind of forced to go to college and do what your parents want you to do. And they wanted me to be a dentist, and I didn't. And so college was great. It was an excellent, excellent experience. And if anybody here hasn't been to college, I highly recommend it. Here was my college experience. Monday to Thursday, make plans for Friday to Sunday. And spend Friday to Sunday filling yourself up with whatever you can. Beg, borrow, steal, whatever. And then every Monday morning, the same story. Get together on the basketball court, and by comparing pieces of everyone's blackouts, you figure out what you did the weekend before. I said college was a great experience. I never graduated. It took me 3 years to get through 1 year of college, and then they threw me out. But I enjoyed every moment of it. Hence my recommendation. Please, try it out. Don't do it the way I did it, though. Finished college, I got thrown out of college, started working full-time. And here's really where my drinking started to change, because I went from being a weekend or party drinker to be a daily drinker. Come home every day, have a couple of drinks to relax, and then I was so relaxed I'd have to go out and have some fun. And before I knew it, things started getting affected in my life. I didn't even know that unmanageability was creeping in. But the first thing that got affected was my relationship. I was engaged to be married, and her only question was, when are we getting married? Next year, darling. I managed to pull that on for about 10 years, and darling finally got fed up, and that was the end of that relationship. So I'd be drinking, so we'd have less money, so I couldn't take her out and do the things that I used to do, like, you know, chocolates and flowers and other such sundry assortments. And so then we would fight. And then I discovered a really magical quality that alcohol had. Because after two drinks, I got amazingly deaf. I didn't hear a word of what she said. And then I discovered another amazing quality of alcohol. The next morning, I didn't remember. You said that? No, I don't remember. And so my relationship got affected first. The next thing that got affected was money. Because I didn't have enough money to do the things I wanted to do or like to do. Forget someone else, even selfishly, the stuff I wanted to do. The third thing that got affected was work, because I started going in hungover and leaving early and spending work time making phone calls to make arrangements and, you know, promises to pay or begging to borrow and that sort of thing. The fourth thing that got affected was my health, because along with hangovers, I started waking up with mysterious bruises that I couldn't account for, and people would tell me that I'd walked into things, or all kinds of crazy stuff. And then other more financial mess, because I started losing things like watches and phones and clothes and people and good people. I lost good people, friends that had my back, and they didn't want to see me anymore. So this unmanageability started creeping into my life, but I had no idea about it. And I had no idea that I was powerless either. I just thought that everybody drank that like I did. And it amazed me that other people could remember what happened the night before. I thought it happened to everyone. So this went on for a while. And finally, about 2 years after my uncle died, my grandmother was coming home from church early one morning. And I was sitting there and working on my third rum and water. By this time, I dropped the Coke from the rum, because I figured out that if you drank rum with water, then you could buy more rum because you're saving all that money with the Coke. So all these calculations going on, it's great. You can imagine what my financial straits were if I had to think about not spending a buck on a Coke so I could save it for booze. So there I was drinking early morning. My grandmother had a fit. What are you drinking 6 in the morning? Are you an alcoholic? You better go and see Uncle Tony and meet his friends who don't drink. Now this is not the uncle who died. This is the other brother. And listen, when you're 22 in 1984, you don't want to go and see Uncle Tony and his friends who don't drink. But if you love your grandmother as much as I do, just have a few drinks and you go. I don't remember much, and I didn't, but that was my first meeting. I had a few drinks, I went for the meeting, I was in a great mood. People were telling these crazy stories. I could identify with their stories. And then they all stopped. How boring. Why did they stop? It sounded like so much fun. They wanted me to come back. Sorry, bunch of losers, I wasn't coming back. And I left. And that was 1984. And I was 22 years old. And now I have almost 22 years of sobriety, but I'm not 44, I'm now 50. So what happened in those missing 6 years from 1984 to 1990? Here's what happened. Unmanageability and powerlessness. I went through 4 jobs. I just worked my way down the airline scale. I went from Swiss Air to Transworld Airlines to Kuwait Airways to Gulf Air, and then finally even the Arabs wouldn't have me. Then I said, to heck with them, who needs them anyway? Resentment is a great way to start a new career. So I called my boss up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I told him where you could shove the airline industry. And I started a business. I was really successful in this business, and within a year I was bored. And I was playing pool one night with a friend of mine who's a film director. And he said, what are you wasting your time? Come and work for us in film production. I said, this is great. Film production is like carte blanche for an alcoholic. And I was production manager. I got to hold the cash. I got to bribe people. I got to get the kickbacks. Wow. And in those 6 years, those 4 jobs, the business, this airline thing, then I went through this broken engagement, a number of other relationships. Some meaningful, some meaningless, but I went through an enlarged liver when I was 26, and then this motorcycle accident which almost killed me. It really wasn't my fault, I must tell the truth. No, it's true. I was going straight, the road turned right. And that's the truth. I don't remember, but I went back later and I saw the spot, so I know what happened. So I went over this cliff. Like any self-respecting biker, I was not wearing my helmet. It was on the headlamp. The headlamp did not break. The bike was wrecked. I fell 20 feet, split my head open. By the grace of God, this was opposite a police station. And they took me. I wonder if that's an amends I have to make, because I never ever got busted for that. I never got a ticket because they took me to hospital. And then I left the state, so I wonder. But anyway, so that's really how it happened. Relationships, health, money, jobs, business, all over. And in those 6 years, I'd made occasional forays into AA, you know, sometimes under duress and sometimes voluntarily. But AA never worked. I think it also didn't work because I never went sober to a meeting. I always went drunk. And I had this good scheme. If you arrived a few minutes late, you could sneak into the back and then nobody would know who you were. And if you took off before the meeting started, you know, no one could grab you and try to sponsor you and stuff. My sponsor later told me that was called the Half Measures Club. So I did that for about 6 years. And then finally, I came into AA sober for the first time on the 18th of February, not the 22nd of April. So I am not the poster child for AA. I came in, I stayed sober a week, then I slipped. Then 2 weeks, and then I slipped, and then 3 weeks, and I slipped again. So I came back, and I said, I want to get this. How do I get this? And they explained the disease of alcoholism to me. They said it's a threefold disease of mind, body, and soul. So they were explaining powerlessness. They said the first part is a mental obsession so powerful that will overcome both the desire and the necessity to stay sober. And I thought back. 3 months before that, I had had an accident which kept me in a coma for a week. What did I do? Come out of the coma, take a discharge against medical advice, cross the street, enter the nearest bar, had 2 drinks, rented another motorcycle, and rode back to the film unit I was at. So when they talked about obsession so powerful, I could identify with that. Necessity, talk about the enlarged liver. The doctor said if you ever drink again, it'll kill you. I waited maybe 2 or 4 months, I can't remember. I know it was a good period of time. And then I started again. So, they said, but if you know all this stuff, why did you pick up the first drink? And I said, I don't know. They said, that's powerlessness. And then they talked about unmanageability. And the unmanageability wasn't about not having a job and stuff like that. It was the unmanageability of my thinking. You know what my mind said in that hospital? If you leave now, you'll feel better and you'll be able to ride straight if you have 2 drinks. That is the insanity that they were talking about. That this time I'll manage better. Next time I'll be able to do it in control. And then step two, I didn't believe in a power greater than myself. And I didn't believe that I was insane. So I wasn't sure about step three. And there was no way I was going to turn my will or my life over to the care of God, whom I didn't understand with the kind of religious upbringing that I had. So needless to say, I relapsed over and over again. But when I had that last drink on the 22nd of April, the next morning I was walking down, I was up on a mountain, I was visiting some of my clients, I still kept my business running. And I was hiking back to the rail station to take a train back to Bombay. And as I was going down, I kept asking myself, why did you pick up that drink last night? And my last drink was great. I had two shots of scotch and half a bottle of wine, didn't get drunk, great night, play the guitar under the campfire stars, another wonderful experience. But walking down the next morning, I kept asking myself, why did you pick up that drink? Couldn't answer. And somewhere from deep within me, I had my moment of truth, and I admitted to my innermost self that I did not have the power to say no. And if I did not have the power to say no, if I didn't have the mental or physical power to say no, then I had just identified with everybody in the rooms that I'd been avoiding for 6 years. And I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And that was the first step in my recovery. I came back to Bombay, attended a meeting that night, and there was a guy speaking, and he destroyed my last argument in AA. Because till that time, I used to always say, I'm the youngest, you guys don't know. You know, all I was interested on Friday night was finding a girl and having some fun. And, you know, they were interested in sobriety. But the guy who was speaking that night was 16 years sober. And he had got sober at the age of 20. So, wow. I asked him to sponsor me after the meeting and he said, why? I said, aren't you supposed to do that? He said, no. He said, I'm not supposed to sponsor anybody. He said, if you look at the big book, all I'm supposed to do is share my experience with you if you are willing to go to any lengths to get what I have. If you are willing to quit for good. I said, I've already quit. When? Yesterday. So he said, okay, why have you stopped drinking? I said, what do you mean, why have I stopped drinking? I looked at him like he had two heads. I said, if there was some way that I could drink, I would drink. I've tried in AA, out of AA, but I cannot drink anymore. That's why I've stopped. I said, okay, that sounds pretty powerless. I said, so where are you working? I'm unemployed. Got any money in the bank? About $3 American. What does your girlfriend say? I'm single again. And where are you living? With my grandmother. He said, yeah, your life is not unmanageable, it's unbelievable. He said, you're fine. You've taken step one. I said, this is great. So he said, okay, do you believe in God? And I said, no. And I swear to you, Franco C. He said, I'm sorry, kid. You don't have a hope in hell. You will drink again and you will die. I said, what do you mean? He said, AA is about only two things. It's about booze and it's about God, whichever way you sell it, spell it. Group of drunks, good orderly direction, get out of debt, whatever you want. But it's about God and it's about booze. One is going to kill you. One is going to kill you. And the other is going to save you. Nothing else. I said, well, but my father, this, my mom. He said, I'm not interested. He said, he's asking you to believe in a power greater than yourself. Why are you asking me to sponsor you? You're sober 16 years old. So he said, would you grudgingly concede that where alcohol is concerned, I am a power greater than you? I said, yes. He said, great. You've just taken step two. I'm a power greater than you. He said, let me help you with that concept. He said, do you have any friends left? I said, yeah, a few. He said, what's so great about them? Now, what I did not know was that he was doing page 46 and 47 of the big book with me, where it says, you form a concept of God as you understand God, provided it makes sense to you. And he said, what's so great about these friends? And I said, oh, they're this and this and that. Paper, pen, write it down. They're loyal, they have my back, they lend me money, they forgive all my crap. So I had this whole list of 8 or 9 things. And this guy, he said to me, he said, if by some accident there's actually a God in this universe, wouldn't you like God to have those qualities? I said, yeah. He said, well, you can use that as your concept. Wow, that was so simple. I did not need to believe in somebody else's conception of God. My own conception, however inadequate that was sufficient at that point. He said, great, so now you've done step one and two. Let's do step three. So I said, okay. And he said, kneel down. I said, excuse me? Now, in India, we are not so polite. We don't say, excuse me. I said, what? So he said, like this. And he knelt down and he said, repeat after me. He said, if there is a God, please keep me sober today. So I said that, and he said, get up. So I said, fine, it's 8:30 now, so when you get home tonight, if you are still sober, you say, if there is a God, thank you. I said, okay, and then? He said, and then you keep doing that until one of two things happen. Either you're going to drink again, or you're going to come to believe. I said, wow. So he said, great. You've done step one, two, and three. So next, we are going to do step four. I said, no, but the last 6 years, I've heard people say, take your time. You need to have at least 4 years before you start step four. I said, really? Well, at least 90 days. I'm like bargaining. He had asked me, will you do anything I ask you to do? And I had said yes. He said, you're going to do step four now. So what? We crossed the street. He bought me a 200-page notebook. I still get, you know, palpitations when I see those gray, black and gray marble-lined notebooks. So he bought that book for me. I was broke. And on the first page he wrote, I am a liar. And he said, here you are. Now you start writing your fourth step. So that's really how I took step 1, 2, and 3 the first day that I was back in AA on the 22nd of April 1990. I haven't found it necessary to drink again since then. Next week I'll share on whatever else they write on the board over here. But the only rider to that is that in the last 21 years, my concept of God has changed. My concept of God has got more formalized. I now am a member of an organized religion. You know, I don't exactly practice it the way they tell me to practice it, but it's now practicing these principles in all my affairs. I practice this religion as I understand it. The guys in charge in the pointy hats may not understand it the way I do, but I'm happy with it. So that has happened. I've come to believe in that. And the other thing is that making this decision to turn my will and life over on a daily basis is not a problem at all. Because my will is my thinking, and that always got me into trouble. And my life is just a series of actions based on my will. I just told you about my life. Not a pretty picture. I don't want to go back to that life. It's much easier for me to ask God every morning to take my life and do whatever the heck He wants with it. And sometimes I have to do that several times a day. Now, before I end tonight, you know, I see that the treasurer has not passed the basket, so I need to speak about that for a little bit. Because AA is completely self-supporting, which means we pay for our own expenses. And I'd like to share one of my own experiences. So I was sitting in a meeting one day, and I had that kind of sponsor, like, you know, I was watching everything you were doing. You know, you came in, if you try to sit at the back, he'd say, up front, that's for you. You know, and he kept that up till I had like about 4 years. And so one day the basket came and I just passed it to the next person. So he didn't wait for the meeting to be over. He pulled me out. So what happened back there? So what do you mean? He said, you didn't put anything in the basket. I said, oh, I didn't have money. He said, I saw you smoke a cigarette before the meeting. I said, but today with cigarettes being more expensive than big books, that's at least 50 cents for a cigarette. And I know you smoke one before the meeting, one at the coffee break, one after. There's no reason why you can't drop $2 in the basket. Today, thank God, I don't have to drink anymore. AA is not asking me to put the price of a beer in the basket, but maybe $2 wouldn't hurt. I want to thank the Lindbrook Group for asking me to speak. And now we'll open it up to show of hands.